Local news, culture, and NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, President Donald Trump has targeted transgender and non-binary people with a series of executive orders since he returned to office. Local LGBTQ advocate John Stephen Hellman says that the spate of executive orders aimed at stifling LGBTQ rights signals a broader and more dangerous trend, one that's not just a matter of policy, but a deep-rooted attack on the very existence of the community. He joins us live. We'll meet a firefighter participating in the Sullivan 180 Healthiest Fire Department Challenge. Maggie Fitzpatrick is moving toward health with her column in the Sullivan County Democrat today, talking about parenting and fitness, and says if it's too hard to do for you, do it for them. And the big Delaware Valley Arts Alliance 2025 season opening exhibit this weekend. We'll learn more right after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. President Trump is scheduled to hold talks with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House today. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports the meeting comes at a crucial time for the ceasefire in Gaza.
Netanyahu was invited to the White House by Trump, the first foreign leader to visit Trump since he began his second term. The two leaders have much to discuss, like the Abraham Accords and the normalization of relations with Saudi Arabia and how to deal with Iran. But most immediately is Gaza, as talks of the next phase of the fragile ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas begin this week, with the U.S. acting as a key mediator. Trump has also recently floated the very controversial idea of relocating Palestinians from Gaza to neighboring Egypt or Jordan, something Palestinians, Egypt, and Jordan all reject. Netanyahu and Trump are expected to hold a press conference later this evening after they meet. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The government efficiency cost-cutting team led by tech billionaire Elon Musk is facing continued backlash for gaining access to a federal payment system at the Treasury Department. Natasha Sarin was the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Economic Policy at Treasury during the Biden administration. She says she can't think of a legitimate reason why Musk has access to the system.
What you're talking about here is that Elon Musk and Doge can be in charge of deciding what programs they want to keep paying out and what Social Security beneficiaries should keep getting their benefits.
Two federal government employee unions and the Alliance for Retired Americans have filed a lawsuit against Elon Musk and Doge. The suit claims that they are illegally accessing the personal information of government workers and taxpayers. Stocks on Wall Street opened mixed this morning after President Trump dialed back the opening salvo in his trade war. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow slipped 12 points in early trading.
Investors breathed a sigh of relief after Trump agreed to suspend 25% tariffs on imports from Mexico and Canada for at least a month. The move came after the two countries made face-saving concessions to strengthen border security. The Trump administration followed through, however, with a smaller 10% tax on imports from China, which took effect just after midnight. China's pushing back by taxing U.S. exports of coal, crude oil, and natural gas, and by launching a new antitrust investigation of Google. Stock in Pepsi lost a little fizz after the soft drink and snack giant reported disappointing quarterly sales. Pepsi's repeated price hikes have prompted some shoppers to switch to cheaper store brand chips and soda pop. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks are trading mixed on Wall Street at this hour. The Dow is down 5 points. The Nasdaq Composite up 162. The S&P up 21 points. This is NPR. Recent wildfires in Los Angeles County have left thousands of farm workers laboring in unhealthy air pollution. NPR's Nate Perez reports these workers have limited protections to help with smoke inhalation.
Smoke from the Hughes Fire in late January quickly spread to Ventura County, where thousands of farm workers pick strawberries, citrus, and other produce. Nonprofits scrambled to get around 21,000 N95 respirators to people in the fields. Elizabeth Strader with the United Farm Workers says workers are concerned about their health, but have no choice but to work.
And there are long-term effects. You know, we know that it damages the heart. We know that it damages their lungs.
Employers in California are legally required to provide N95 respirators to workers when the air quality index reaches 150. Oregon and Washington are the only other states that also have this requirement. Nate Perez, NPR News.
The University of California system is being sued for alleged racial discrimination. A group called Students Against Racial Discrimination is accusing nine of the university's campuses of favoring Black and Latino applicants over what it calls better qualified white and Asian American applicants. In a statement, the university said its undergraduate admissions applications collect data on students' race and ethnicity for statistical purposes only, and that they are not used for admission. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 5 points, the Nasdaq up 177. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Donald Trump kicked off his second presidential term with dozens of executive orders, many of which focus on hot-button culture war issues, from diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives to abortion and transgender rights. Local LGBTQ rights advocate John Stephen Hellman has voiced grave concerns over the escalating political attacks targeting the LGBTQ community, particularly transgender individuals. Hellman says these executive orders aimed at stifling LGBTQ rights signals a broader and more dangerous trend, one that's not just a matter of policy, but a deep-rooted attack on the very existence of the community. John Stephen Hellman joins us right now. He's also president of the Zimmerman Purse Democrats, Pike County, Pennsylvania's first LGBTQ Democratic Club dedicated to defending the rights and lives of LGBTQ people in Pike County and throughout Pennsylvania. John, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tim.
We talked about some of these hot-button issues, particularly among targeted toward transgender individuals. What are the specific orders or actions from the Trump administration that stand out for you, and why are they particularly dangerous to the LGBTQ community, in your view?
Yeah, so I think there are two elements of this that are really deeply concerning. I think the first is the fact that there are so many different orders that are really trying to cover a broad area to attack transgender communities and to dismantle the very little legal protections that were in place. In particular, the denial of gender-affirming care, the fact that the government is in the business of trying to define what the official government stance of what a man and a woman is, and making sure that all of these resources have been completely eliminated from the CDC, from DHS, from all of these places that were analyzing and studying the impacts of various things on communities, like all of this is gone. So the fact that these really broad things have been put in place it's really staggering. And we knew this was coming because this has been really clearly outlined in Project 2025, which was brought up a lot during last year's election. But the fact that it's here now and that it's happening is still really shocking.
And you mentioned Project 2025 and its influence on current policy. Can you explain a little bit more about how it's shaping the political landscape for LGBTQ rights?
Absolutely. So Project 2025 really clearly outlined in various different ways the elimination of any infrastructure that supports the LGBTQ community. And the things that President Trump is signing with his executive orders are a copy and paste of what was in the plan. So there's such a clear link between what is going on nationally and what was in the report. And I know there's a attempt in Idaho, I believe, to ban same-sex marriage that's only designed to go to the Supreme Court. So which this is also outlined in Project 2025 to eliminate same-sex marriage. So it's just, this is all happening in the order that is outlined in this project, and we knew this was coming, and the fact that it's happening is horrifying.
There seems to be a focus on transgender rights. They seem to be at the forefront of these attacks. What do you think the consequences will be if these policies continue to target the transgender community specifically?
Well, even now, where we don't really know how these particular executive orders are going to be implemented. And of course, that there are various different ways that different states are going to implement this. The impact is already very real. I know that there are people that I know personally that are moving out of the country. They are going back into the closet. They are really furiously trying to get all of their documentation in order before they get held up at an airport or held up trying to access their benefits. There is really widespread panic and fear going on. And we know based off of the research that they're trying to eliminate that transgender communities in particular are vulnerable and suffer from higher mental health issues because of this vulnerability. So we can anticipate that there's going to be more kids, more teenagers, more adults attempting self-harm. There's going to be more of these folks that are depressed and anxious. And it's just like the real harm cannot be overstated. And it's just a month into this new term. We really, it could only get worse from here if this trend continues.
Do you think that some of these hot button issues like LGBTQ rights and some of these other culture war tactics that they've rolled out here, do you think these are used to deflect from larger issues? And how do you think these things are connected? Is it sort of a scapegoating play as part of the political strategy?
I think the answer is yes and no. Yes, it is a scapegoating strategy, and there is a particular donor base for conservatives in this country that really want to see transgender rights and transgender affirming care, all of this dismantled. So I think this is one of the goals, but it also is a means to an end. Despite the fact that voters aren't really saying that this is one of their priorities, we saw based off of a lot of the data that has come out of the election that people are concerned about the cost of living. People are concerned about security and immigration. People are not saying that the fact that trans people can use a particular bathroom or play on a sports team or access medical care is something that is dominating what keeps them up at night. And I will say that what really should concern everyone, even if you are not a fan of transgender communities, this is the government telling us that a particular group of people should not have access to healthcare. And the government should not be in the business of denying healthcare, especially when so many of us cannot afford, cannot access, cannot even find an appointment for a doctor right now. We should be expanding healthcare for everyone and not dunking on communities that are already vulnerable.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to John Stephen Hellman, local LGBTQ rights advocate and president of the Zimmerman Purse Democrats, the Pike County, Pennsylvania's first LGBTQ Democratic Club. They're dedicated to defending the rights and lives of LGBTQ people in Pike County and throughout Pennsylvania. John, you mentioned health and healthcare. There are many LGBTQ health centers and nonprofits where folks go to feel safe to receive healthcare. Do you have concern over the survival of some of these centers? And how do you think that they can adapt to stay afloat?
Absolutely. I'm very concerned, especially with the stunt that happened last week about freezing federal funding to weed out woke ideology that the federal government is paying for through nonprofits. I think that a lot of LGBT organizations are in the position right now to look at their finances, and a lot of them depended on federal money. So what's going to happen is there's going to be a focus on other sources of funding. And unfortunately, because of attacks on things such as DEI and some of this other stuff that the Trump administration has already engaged in, corporate money that has usually been behind sponsoring things like Pride, sponsoring transgender organizations and other LGBT organizations, those funds are also drying up. So I think that if this continues in this way, we're going to see a lot of organizations have to close their doors unless other forms of state funding or personal contributions go in to take its place. And unfortunately, I think there's no way to really know if that's going to happen. I know that they rescinded this order. We don't know what the actual impact of this federal funding freeze or them reprioritizing federal funding is actually going to do. But the risk is real. And I think by the end of this year alone, there's going to be a lot of pain felt in the LGBT nonprofit community.
just as a note, the judge extended the pause on that funding freeze after finding that the Trump administration had not complied with the judge's order. So we'll see how that plays out. But, you know, as you said, it's only been a couple of weeks. People are already exhausted, I think. But how can folks rally and support the LGBTQ community? You mentioned the importance of maintaining visibility and educating others about LGBTQ issues.
Yeah, I think the answer that we had all along is exactly what we need to be doing today. We need to be sharing our stories as LGBTQ people, as allies. If we have loved ones or close friends that are LGBTQ, we need to be sharing our stories not only to humanize us, but to really tell people the real harm and pain that's being caused in our lives and the real disruptions from contributing to our communities, contributing to our economies, contributing to the reasons why some of our communities are really beautiful and wonderful places to live. This has caused so much harm and disruption already, and we need to be much more active with our local and state officials, despite whatever letter is next to their name. Their jobs are to represent their constituents. So I just want to encourage everyone, if you have never spoken to a representative before, it is not scary, and your story is the most important asset that you have that they take very seriously. So call your local officials, call your state officials, call your members of Congress, and tell them exactly how you feel and what you think about what they're doing. They don't know your position unless you tell them what their position is.
I mentioned you're the president of the Zimmerman First Democrats, the LGBTQ Democratic Club in Pike County. Talk a little bit more about what you guys are doing to defend the rights and lives of LGBTQ people in Pike County, how folks can get involved. And then also, if you're not in Pike County and you're listening, how folks can get involved, do you think, regionally?
Yeah, so there, for us in Pike County, our emphasis really is to do two things. We're going to maintain our visibility and make sure that LGBTQ people and allies where we live understand that they don't have to go back in the closet. They don't have to be afraid, that there are people that are loud and visible advocating for our rights in our communities. And we're also going to be creating deeper relationships with our local officials. You know, there are last year when we led the charge to get four different municipalities in our county to recognize June as LGBTQ Pride Month, the majority of people that said yes were Republicans, not Democrats, not independents. They were Republicans. So we have to dislodge this idea that just because you're part of a particular party, we can assume that we know what your stance is. So we have to talk to them. We have to introduce ourselves. We have to get them to see that we are here, we are part of the community they represent, and that our interests are important. And that's exactly what everyone should do, even if you don't have a local LGBTQ organization in your town or your county. You can be the change that we need so desperately, and you don't know the impact of your story on a staffer or on a member of Congress unless you give it a shot. So that's the most important thing that you can do. Use your voice. Your voice is valuable. And let's see what we can do together if we all use our voices relentlessly this year.
Despite the of adversity, you point out that the LGBTQ community has always shown resilience. What gives you hope in this current moment of heightened attacks?
Honestly, young people are what give me hope. I am almost 40, and I remember a time in my teenage years where there was some LGBTQ visibility, but it did not even compare to what we have now. And when I go visit LGBTQ students and hear them talk about pronouns and respecting each other as such a banal, just another thing to talk about besides what do you want to eat for lunch or what homework do you have, it gives me so much hope that younger generations really understand that this isn't some wild, controversial thing like respecting people for who they are. It's something that we all would love ourselves, and we owe it to each other to give to other people. So I would just look towards how incredible LGBTQ youth are behaving in the face of all of this. And that gives me hope And that's why I will continue fighting to make sure that my community is safe and have what they need going forward.
Before we go, do you think that this current state of affairs here in the country will be galvanizing for folks and LGBTQ rights? Do you think there's a potential turning point here?
I think so. I think what we're seeing now is, especially with LGBTQ people, like, these issues are not causing the kind of harm that people are saying are important to them. The number one reason why kids in America are killed is because of gun violence, not because of trans people or drag queens. Trans-affirming care is not the reason why people have deteriorating access to their own healthcare services. We're not the reason why our roads are crumbling and our institutions are fading away. And I think people are really seeing these attacks for what they are. It's not solving anyone's problems. And I think that there are a lot of people that are really seeing that. The number of people that are reaching out to me saying, I want to get involved, has been really overwhelming in the last week and a half. And we're not going to let this happen the same way that we did in the first Trump administration. And I think people are going to be really surprised by our community's response to what is happening, and our elected officials are going to need to respond in kind.
John Stephen Hellman is the president of the Zimmerman Purse Democrats, the Democratic Club in Pike County, Pennsylvania, the LGBTQ Democratic Club dedicated to defending the rights and lives of LGBTQ people in Pike County and throughout Pennsylvania. There's more information on their Facebook page, Zimmerman Purse Democrats. It's spelled P-E-I-R-C-E. John Stephen Hellman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Tim.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, Sullivan 180's Healthiest Fire Department Challenge. We'll meet one of the firefighters who's participating. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, why are penicillin allergies so often misdiagnosed?
A whole generation of doctors were trained thinking that penicillin allergy was very dangerous.
And what other medical myths do we still believe?
Future generations will ask themselves, what was Grandpa thinking of?
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. This afternoon at 1 o'clock on Radio Catskill.
This week on the Retro Cocktail Hour, there's Mambo at the Mocambo. Les Baxter goes Latin, and we'll hear Tiki Lounge TV themes. Daryl Brogdon here. Join me where the music is shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Firefighting is one of the most physically and emotionally challenging professions, with responders placing themselves at risk every time they answer a call. The Firefighter Cancer Support Network reports that just the sound of the emergency tones causes a firefighter's heart rate to increase 47 beats per minute, highlighting the immediate stress their bodies endure even before reaching the scene. Concerns like high blood pressure, heart disease, and mental health challenges have long been linked to the profession. That's why Sullivan 180's Healthiest Fire Department Challenge is designed to address those issues, encouraging fire departments locally to prioritize wellness and resilience both on and off the job. Sullivan 180 Outreach Program Manager Lindsay Wheat and Jill Holland, a Healthiest Fire Department Challenge Captain and Firefighter with the Conneaugh Lake Fire Department, join us now. Hi, guys.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Thank you for coming in. Jill, so I've talked to Lindsay a lot about the Sullivan 180 Fire Department Challenge, and we'll talk more about that, but I want to talk to you first.
Oh, so I'm old news.
Just sit over there quietly. No. Jill, I want to talk to you about being a fire department, Healthiest Fire Department Challenge Captain. Explain what the challenge entails and why do you think it's so important for fire departments to participate like Conneaugh Lake?
Well, being a challenge captain is actually challenging. Unfortunately, with Conneaugh Lake Fire Department, we have a tremendous buy-in with the Healthiest Fire Department Challenge. We are in our third year of the program. It's really made a huge change in the culture within our fire department as far as thinking about health and wellness, camaraderie. It's just been really great to see the changes and things. You know, with the Healthiest Fire Department Challenge, we're able to earn points for different activities, everything from our Sunday walks, which we've been doing for 3 years straight with our family, our pets, our kids, our grandkids, right down to going in and listening to webinars, having speakers come in and doing different activities with other fire departments in the community. That's been a huge thing as well.
Can you share any personal stories or examples of other firefighters that you've seen benefiting from this challenge, like particularly in terms of improving their health outcomes?
Oh, absolutely. You know, in my fire department alone, we've had one firefighter that it's the first time in 25 years they've gone to the doctor because these changes in their lifestyle
Wow.
have really, you know, of course, we have our annual physicals and things like that. But going to the doctor, getting more testing, wanting to know their numbers, their baseline health and things like that has made a huge impact. Another firefighter, January 1st, she went cold turkey, non-smoking. Last night at drill, she is still not smoking. So that's been another huge, huge thing within our department. And I know out speaking with other members of other departments, you know, there's members, there's firefighters out there who are managing their diabetes by going on regular walks, eating healthier, staying hydrated, you know, and the whole big thing with earning the points and things like that, it's so much more than that. It's the change in the culture. It's the change in the lifestyle. It's educating ourselves because as volunteers, firefighters, we are at a higher risk for a lot of other health concerns, everything from increased risk for cancer, for cardiac issues, for health and wellness resiliency. We have these stressors because as volunteers, we not only have our regular jobs, our families, you know, we're getting up out of bed at 3 o'clock in the morning to answer a call. And that puts them even more stress. You know, we might be at a big fire and we're missing our family's birthday parties or things like that. That puts more stress. So having these opportunities to learn about how to cope with those things, finding balance in our lives through this Healthiest Fire Department Challenge and all that Lindsay and 180 has done is just tremendous.
You know, living rurally here, we hear those fire horns go off. And sometimes they're the regular sounds like at what noon and six sometimes mm-hmm. in certain communities. But when it's not that regular time, and I'm not a volunteer fire department, I get stressed. I hear that and think, oh my goodness, something's going on. I can only imagine what it's like for the firefighters who are always on call, ready to go at a moment's notice.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people here in the community who have moved in the community, they're not aware that out of 40 out of our volunteer fire departments, 39 of them are all volunteers. Our one combination department is still supplemented. The career firefighters supplement the volunteers. So we are all volunteer fire departments here in Sullivan County in one way or another. And, you know, we don't live at the firehouse. We don't get out, you know, we don't jump from the bed and slide down the pole and there in 15 minutes.
Right.
You know, we've got to get up, get dressed, go to the bathroom, get ready to go in our, you know, brush the snow off our trucks and things like that to get ready to go to an alarm and things. And then most of us turn around and we come back. We clean up our gear and our equipment. And then a lot of times it's a shower and to work for the day.
Lindsay, I have not forgotten about you. How do you measure the success at Sullivan 180 of the Healthiest Fire Department Challenge? And what other feedback have you heard from departments participating?
I don't know if I even have any more words. I feel like Jill just covered it. No, Jill just did a really great job on really highlighting what a day or a night of a volunteer is. And that's why we found and it made sense that volunteer firefighters are leading in obesity and diabetes, you know, cardiac issues and leading in suicide more than any other first responder. So that's why it was very important to us to focus on our local volunteers. And just hearing the benefits of, you know, first and foremost, this was a platform for health. But we're seeing it as a platform for bringing families together, that camaraderie, and also, you know, for connecting with the community. So what initially was just for health and wellness has really become a platform for so many things. And we're seeing that in our third year now.
And we have, you said 39 fire departments. Do you have full participation or do you want to get everybody involved? What's the message out there to those folks that are involved?
why are you involved? Yes. We're having so much fun. You know, if you follow us on our website on Sullivan 180, and then on our social media, you'll every single week we have our Firefighter Friday and we're posting what these apartments are doing. And it's fun. So we're getting healthy, but we're actually having a really good time doing it together.
Yeah. Fun, but also doing some really meaningful work too. Jill, you're a community health champion trainer. Can you explain a little bit about what that is and how programs that you're involved with this Healthiest Fire Department Challenge kind of tie back into just the overall health and well-being to support mental health for first responders?
Sure. And, you know, one of the other great things of Sullivan 180 is their community programs that they bring to the community. The one that, as a trainer I am in is a program called QPR, Question, Persuade, Refer, which is really suicide awareness and intervention. And the one program that I do specifically is tailored, to the fire EMS, 911 dispatchers, but really to the fire departments. And we've gone actually in-house into the fire departments and taught right directly to them and raised awareness and started the conversations of it's okay not to be okay. And, you know, recognizing it in ourselves, recognizing it in the people that we work alongside of, and in reaching out and saying, you know what, I've noticed this about you. Are you okay? Can we get you some help? Can we get you some resources and things? And really just helping people before they even get to that point. Providing tools and resources and education and awareness to them.
And we mentioned that you're part of the Conneauga Lake Fire Department. You've been participating for about 3 years. Haven't had any big wins in the challenge necessarily, but what keeps the department engaged?
You know what? We didn't have big wins monetarily with the big prizes, but we had so many big wins in terms of our departments coming together. You know, growing up in the fire service, I learned the firehouse was a hub. We always did family things. We always did around the firehouse. You know, our jobs nowadays, COVID really kind of pushed that away. And seeing this now with us getting together, doing things, having a potluck with our mutual aid company and coming together, you know, that's been huge and bringing that culture back. But I think, you know, the Turtle Awards, I think the best thing about this challenge is it's not just about the big prize money. The Turtle Awards for us as a department the last 2 years, you know, earning over, I think, over $4,000 that our department has brought in through Turtle Awards, through very, very generous community organizations and businesses that we can't thank enough. You know, we've been able to buy gym equipment, which when we started this challenge, we had nothing but our sneakers and a Sunday walk. Mm-hmm. So now we have exercise equipment. We have an amazing smart board TV where the one night where we couldn't go on a walk because it was so cold outside, we put on a video and we walked around our meeting room and we use that for webinars and other live trainings. And those are the win-win things. And getting together, we just brought in this year, having yoga 2 times a month. And to bring in yoga in my firehouse and in that culture, it's just that was a win-win in itself. But to see it each week, more and more members, to see our chief doing yoga, and then to have members come and say, you know what, we're doing this 2 times a month. Could we see if she can come 4 times a month and come every week? That just, for me, that warms my heart. And I get teary-eyed over it because I see these little small changes that have made a huge impact. Taking soda out of our refrigerator in the firehouse, you know, I met no resistance. They might have been afraid of me, but you know what? That culture is no more soda in the firehouse. You want soda, you bring it in yourself, but we're not bringing in snacks for rehab on a fire scene. It's not Snickers bars anymore. It's healthier options. And that's what it's all about, is the little small changes that have made a huge impact.
You're not the only one getting teary-eyed over here, Jill. It's Lindsay and I fighting back the tears here. Thank you for that testimony about why it's so important, because it is so meaningful, Lindsay. I mean, this is great to hear because it really does have that impact. And again, the Healthiest Fire Department Challenge, as Jill mentioned, has some big awards for some of those departments. But talk about how just this kind of impact is so meaningful.
Yeah. I'm not crying. You're crying. So But Jill brought up a great point about yoga in the fire department. So when we first thought of this crazy idea, it was like, how do we ask these firefighters to do yoga? But this has actually been something across the board that they've been interested in experimenting with. But so it might not be that first or second prize, but we have those turtle awards, like Jill shared, that are sponsored by our local organizations or just community members. That is a $500 sponsorship that goes to the departments like Kanyanga Lake, so that maybe they didn't take home that first or second place, but they really focus in certain areas like mental health or physical health or nutrition, and really allows them to buy equipment and anything else to really continue their journey in health.
If someone's listening and also wiping away tears, how can they learn more information about the Healthiest Fire Department Challenge? Maybe there's a fire department out there or a firefighter listening and saying, hey, we want to be involved. How can they learn more?
So for the fire departments to become involved, you would contact me, which is Lindsay, L-I-N-D-S-A-Y, at Sullivan180.org, to follow the fire department challenge, which please do. There is a live tracker on there of who's in the lead. That's that competitive piece of this competition, which is a lot of fun as well. But you would go on to Sullivan180.org. But if you are not part of a fire department at all and you would like to become a member,
You can actually check out Join Sullivan Fire, our Facebook page. Shoot us a message, shoot us an email, and we can connect you up. There is a job for everyone in the fire service.
Thank you both so much. We've been talking to Sullivan 180's Outreach Program Manager Lindsay Wheat and Jill Holland, a Healthiest Fire Department Challenge Captain and Firefighter with the Kanyanga Lake Fire Department. There's more information at Sullivan180.org. And what was the address for Join Sullivan?
You can check out the Join Sullivan Fire Facebook page.
That's it. Thank you both so much. And Jill, thank you for your service.
Thank you.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, we're going to continue moving toward health, this time with Maggie Fitzpatrick, the health and wellness columnist from the Sullivan County Democrat. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Sullivan 180. Building healthy communities through people, places, and policy, one degree at a time. More information at Sullivan180.org. From The River Reporter, the community newspaper covering four counties in Pennsylvania and New York along the Upper Delaware River. RiverReporter.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hi, this is Marco Werman, host of The World. Weekdays at 3, our newsroom connects you with events around the globe. Our reporters in the Americas, Africa, Europe, and Asia get to the heart of the day's news. We bring you international perspectives on issues worldwide and here in the U.S. It's 1 hour each day that broadens horizons and takes you beyond our borders. Join me on The World, afternoons at 3, on Radio Catskill.
You are listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. In her latest Moving Toward Health column for the Sullivan County Democrat, health and wellness coach Maggie Fitzpatrick is sharing some valuable insights on the physical benefits of strength training, particularly for parents. Maggie says that while many parents, especially mothers, feel fear lifting weights due to concerns about bulking up or getting injured, strength training is actually a crucial tool for injury prevention and overall well-being. And Maggie joins us now. Hi.
Hi.
What I always ask you this, what motivated this column? You're not a mom or parent yourself, but you have some little ones in your life?
Yes, I do have 12 nieces and nephews.
12?
Yeah. There's no pressure on me, thank goodness. But yes, not a parent yet. Hopefully one day. But I, you know, you see, of course, lots of parents with their young children, and you see them having to do everything, right? You do all of your normal daily activities while holding at least one child, maybe multiple, right? And that's very challenging. And so we have to be strong enough to do that.
There's a lot of movement with parenting. How does strength training benefit parents specifically who lift and carry their kids regularly?
I think that there's a bunch of ways, but the first thing we want to think about is the fact that when we are, we'll call it working, right? So this could be your job that's physical labor. It could be taking care of children. When we're doing that, we're putting stress on our body in a way that makes it tired and breaks it down,
right? And in order to have a higher tolerance of the amount of work that our body can handle, we have to do specific types of work that makes our body tired but builds it up. And that's where strength training comes in, because it's very intentional type of work that allows our body to get stronger instead of just getting tired and breaking down. And then that's when you lead to injuries. So you want to make sure that you're doing very intentional training. It doesn't have to be a ton, right? Even if you did one day per week, that would help, because then that is helping to create a foundation of your body's ability to take on all of that work that you're doing.
You mentioned in the introduction about moms who might worry about getting bulky from lifting weights. Why do you think that fear exists, and how can you address it for someone who's maybe just starting out or beginning this strength training?
I think that fear exists because we see a lot of what we see when we think of people who do strength training is bodybuilding, right? Or powerlifting or something like that. And you see these people who have a crazy amount of muscle mass, and it is extremely hard to build that much muscle. It's so hard. It's a full-time job. And so when we are doing strength training for just like basic living, we're not going to acquire that much muscle. That would be wild if we did. But it's a fear because that's what we see, right? And that's what we see. And there's this narrative that I'm not sure why it exists, but it still does exist, that when we do strength training, we will look like that. And that's not the truth.
Well, talking about fear too, you talk about the irony of avoiding strength training due to fear. How do you think people can shift their mindset to embrace it?
Yeah. So when we're afraid of something, that usually leads us to not do something else, right? So if we're afraid of injury or we're afraid of becoming bulky from strength training, that leads us to not doing strength training because of this fear, right? Where the reality is that not strength training is what is going to lead to the injury. Where if we do the strength training, that's when we have a better chance of avoiding the injury. I won't say that there's 100% chance, because not true. But we're priming our body and preparing
the muscle
to avoid the injury. And so it is a little bit ironic, and this happens in a lot of areas of life, where the thing that we're afraid of leads us to not take action on the thing that would actually prevent the thing that we're scared of.
So with parents, you know, and schedules and little ones, how can they find time to strength train, and what kind of exercises would you recommend?
Yeah, I think there's a couple different, we'll call them hacks, right, that we could do. One is to incorporate your child into the workout as much as possible. Like, use them as the weight, right? we're doing squats, things like that. It might seem silly, but once we can overcome that stigma of like, oh, this is weird, it's actually quite helpful, because your child probably wants you to hold them, right? And you need to exercise. So how can we do those things together? And then the other thing is that we need to break the mindset that your workout has to be extremely long. It doesn't. It can just be a couple sets, a couple minutes, broken up into different times throughout the day. If you don't have an extended period of time at once, it doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to get done.
You know, and another plus, unlike a dumbbell, small children, warm and cuddly.
Exactly. Yeah.
What do you think are some of the long-term benefits for strength training, particularly for women?
Yes, there are many, you know, science-wise, of course, our bone density decreases as we age, our muscle mass decreases as we age. We want to improve those things, right? So if we do strength training, we will improve those. But I think my favorite benefit is that your kids are watching you. And what you do is what they're going to do. And how you look at yourself is how they're going to look at themselves. And if you believe in yourself and you take care of yourself, there's a higher chance that they're going to believe in themselves and they're going to take care of themselves too. And I think that that is one of the biggest benefits, that is, it's hard to view it in like a tangible form, but I think it has the most impact.
And we've been talking about parents and moms and dads, but it really is strength training for all age groups is important. Talk a little bit more about long-term health benefits for everybody.
Yeah. Strength training is going to help you, like we were just talking about with bone density, muscle mass, right? It's going to help you improve those things, which is really great for activity as we age. It's also going to help us regulate our weight. It's also going to help us regulate our blood sugar. We've talked about this before, right? If we have more muscle, our body's able to handle the things that we eat more easily, right? It makes eating a little bit less stressful if we have more muscle. It also can help regulate our sleep, right? If we're expending energy through exercise, we're going to sleep better. It can help us with our brain power throughout the day, right? There's endless benefits of strength training. And so if we can start to incorporate it at least 2 to 3 days per week, that's really a great place to aim for.
And as we talked about in the previous segment with the Healthiest Fire Department Challenge, good for mental health as well.
It is.
What advice do you have that you can leave us with to overcome our common obstacles that we all face, like time, motivation, confidence, words of wisdom, Maggie Fitzpatrick?
There's many ways that you can go about it. I think that one of the biggest things that can help us is finding someone to hold us accountable, whether it's a friend, a loved one, a coach, depending on whatever way you want to go. If you share your goals with someone else, you're more likely to do them. Right? You're more likely to stay on track because there's, I don't know if you experience it this way, but for me, I'm kind of thinking like, oh, they might ask me about that because I told them about it, right? We've been talking about me waking up earlier in the morning. Well, people are asking me about it, so I'm doing it, you know? And so I feel like that is a, you know, free, can be free, cost-effective way that can help you with those things because you're just putting it out there. So then you hold yourself a little more accountable.
Thank you, Maggie Fitzpatrick. She is the health and wellness columnist for the Sullivan County Democrat. Her article, which we've been talking about now, is a column, is out now in the Sullivan County Democrat on newsstands or online, scdemocratonline.com. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, a preview of the big DVAA 2025 season opening exhibit that's coming up next. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
This is Kusar Grace, KG, right here in the place to be, WJFF Radio Catskills Music Emporium, Tuesday night, 7 to 9. 2 hours of great music, jazz, funk, blues. I got mellow grooves to help you unwind, exciting rhythms to help you cut loose. Join me Tuesday night for the Music Emporium, 7 to 9, right here on Radio Catskills. Listen local.
The Daily draws on the unrivaled quality and expertise of the New York Times Global Newsroom. Our mission is to tell stories more deeply and to incorporate a new kind of transparency weekday evenings at 6:30 here on Radio Catskill.
You're with Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On Saturday, Delaware Valley Arts Alliance opens its 2025 season, and they have a packed schedule featuring local and regional artists. DVAA's 2025 roster of exhibits run the gamut from painting to printmaking, sculpture to performance art, and everything in between. DVAA Gallery and Grants Manager Tanner Simon is here. He also curated the DVAA member show, which is opening this weekend, and he's brought along a special guest star. One of our local artists is with us as well, Maria Baca Camara. Good morning.
Good morning, Tim. Thank you for having us on the air today. It's great to be back.
Thank you for being here. And tell us a little bit about this exhibit. I mentioned you curated the member show called Assembly Required. What inspired this collaborative exhibition?
Well, there seems to be a lot of tension and division, you know, both internally and within our country.
You don't say.
Yeah, we do. Yeah. And this show was inspired to really bring people together, both in viewing art, but mainly in making art. We wanted artists who were kind of feeling isolated to work with other artists that they might not have ever done before. I mean, collaborating in the art making practice is kind of a rare, beautiful thing. So we had 24 artists come together and make 11 different collaborations. And it's absolutely fantastic. And I've had people say that they had never collaborated before and that they had never thought to do it. And they're so inspired by the new work. You know, it's like being reborn for some of these people. And we have one of them here.
I was going to say, Maria, talk a little bit about your work and your piece that's in this show and how just this collaborative process helped inspire you.
Yes. Well, speaking of being reborn, our collaborative exhibit is a Womb Cove. We made a place of Reckum of tender holding in the gallery where I worked, collaborated with visual artist and sculptor Pam Poquette, who does stuffed paintings. So we started that collaboration based on, I met Pam at another DVA workshop. And when Tanner encouraged me to apply for the show, I got together with Pam, and we assembled between our paintings and myself as a dancer and choreographer that I wanted to dance with her paintings. She has these puffed paintings that are actually tactile that I can hold and dance, as well as be inspired by the feminine shapes of her work. And so we made this cove of a womb cove in the gallery. And as I was dancing in the creative process in the gallery, I met another artist. Our neighboring artist, Willow, is a musician who collaborates with plants. She actually plays the plants tactilely by moving the plants. The plants make their own music.
The plants making the noise.
Yeah.
Is the instrument.
She uses computing to turn the natural electrical signals in the plants into a MIDI signal, like you would play on a MIDI keyboard or a dance pad or a touch pad, into music.
We're only talking about two things here, so my mind's already blown. How many artists do you have in this exhibit that's happening Assembly Required?
There's 24 artists.
Wow.
And 11 projects.
Okay. And then also going on the weekend is another exhibit, a coffee and conversation event with Tori Akers. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, tell us a little bit about that, too.
Well, that's an interesting show called Babo, which is a pre-Roman goddess. And I'm taking this from her directly from how she talks about it on her website. The pre-Roman goddess of body jokes. She's usually portrayed as a uterus with legs and a face. And Zeus stood her up on a date one time. So, Tori has quite the sense of humor and also writes art criticism. You can find it on her website. But yeah, she'll be talking about the project, and that's in our downstairs gallery at 3 p.m. on Saturday. And we will have coffee and conversation. And yeah, it's a show of drawing and painting, whereas upstairs it's kind of a mix of collage, video, performance, dance, plants.
Talk about that, you know, because there's so many different art forms involved, were there challenges bringing together such a diverse group of artists for the exhibition? Or was it just sort of this, as I'm seeing Maria talk about it, it seems like it was just sort of maybe eye-opening and transformative in some ways, and that collaboration just organically occurred?
Well, interestingly enough, I think most of the collaborations happened because they were different art forms. Like, I think we have one collaboration, or there's two collaborations that are like both painters working together. Most of them are like someone who's a musician and a dancer, or a photographer and someone who does collage. So they kind of complement each other. Like, David Soti is a photographer, a wildlife photographer. And then Paul Plumador is using his images, and, you know, they're making these weird abstract compositions from something really like formal and, you know, pristine to this new abstract, crazy form that you can't tell it's an eagle anymore. And it's just such an interesting collaboration where none of them have done anything like, you know, working together like that before.
Maria, what role do you think collaboration plays in the growth of being an artist and you know, the evolution of your work? Or have you had a chance to absorb all that yet?
Well, we really egg each other on. I actually interviewed Pam last night in preparation for this interview today on the radio, so we actually have a 90-minute extra bonus that we just kept rolling on in our collaboration, even in our conversation, and that we encourage each other to come out with it. So, for example, our ideas for this exhibit grew so much that, in terms of like even space that we would take up in the gallery, Tanner was like, "You guys should apply for a main show, like a bigger show, so you can take up even more space."
Right.
Yeah.
And we applied for next year's and other residencies to actually turn the puff paintings into more sculptural that I would like to see as a dancer and performer and interactive exhibit, things that you can actually get in. This idea of,
for the audience,
places and sculptures that are, I'm calling, get-in-able.
That's cool.
Yeah, we've unleashed a whole can of worms here. I mean,
Maria's like grunting with it.
Maria has so many ideas, and she's, you know, we want to project, we want to paint the whole gallery. And there's only so much space for collaboration, but that energy is really appreciated.
I mentioned this is the opening exhibit for the 2025 season. Lots going on. Can you talk a little bit more about some upcoming things that you're excited about?
Well, I mean, that day, Saturday, is going to be an extravaganza. We have the artist talk at 3. We have the show opening at 4. We have Maria's performance with Pam and Bruce, and then Willa's performance from like 5 to 5:30 to 6. And then we have our salon series all throughout February and in March. And then at the end, we have on March 29th, I believe, Saturday, March 29th, we have a closing performance by GH and Raphael Shirley, which is an intense rock guitar, or maybe more electronic guitar. I'm excited to see what they come up with, and a light installation, this massive oval that's kind of floating from the ceiling, and GH will play his guitar quite loud, I'm told, in the middle of it. Yeah.
And at the end of our performance, we actually have an invitation to collaborate with the audience, of including participation. We have a aspect of poetry, of improv poetry, into the performance, where I invite the audience to say what they see, and we will make a collaborative poem that will be part of the exhibit that I'm collaborating with a local poet, Bruce Ansbach, as an additional collaborator in our piece.
So you're getting the interactive bit started off a little early, too, this Saturday, right? Yes. All right, so that's coming up at the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance this Saturday. Again, the first exhibit, the Coffee and Conversations, is at 3.
Mm-hmm.
Then the opening exhibit
is at 4.
4. And the performance is at
5. 5. And then 5:30.
Every hour on the hour, something is going on.
No, it's a fun, full art day. That's for great. Sure.
There's more information about that fun, full art day at DelawareValleyArtsAlliance.org. We've been talking to Tanner Simon, the DVAA Gallery and Grants Manager, about that show and that exhibit that's opening up, and also artist Maria Baca Camara. Thank you guys so much. It sounds like a lot of fun. Enjoy it. And come back and tell us about the next one.
Absolutely. Thanks, Tim.
All right. That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A program reminder, a programming note, actually, it's Black History Month, and the African American Public Radio Consortium has collaborated with the BBC to bring together some great music documentaries that we're going to be able to share with you starting tonight at 9. The first one is Feeling Good, the Nina Simone story, hosted by her daughter, Lisa Simone Kelly. And we'll be bringing you those documentaries every Tuesday at 9 throughout February, including Fela, the Afrobeat Revolutionary, The Donnie Hathaway Story, and Curtis Mayfield. But tonight it starts at 9 with Feeling Good, the Nina Simone story, tonight at 9 on Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
I'm Ira Flatow. When did you first get captivated by science? Astronaut Leland Melvin says his interest was sparked literally when his mother gave him a chemistry set.
You know, I created this explosion. I burned her carpet. She ran in the room and, you know, I got a spanking, but my brain was activated to science.
Activate your brain to science on Science Friday on Radio Catskill. Friday, 2 to 4 p.m.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Furniture Restore, located on Main Street in Jeffersonville, specializing in antique and vintage furniture, rugs, art, and lighting, because buying well-made and pre-owned is a better choice for the planet. Online at therestorejville.com. And from The River Reporter, the community newspaper serving 4 counties along the Delaware River in Pennsylvania and New York, riverreporter.com. And from listeners like you.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's forecast, mostly cloudy skies, a high of 33, and temperatures falling down to 12 by the evening. Winds could occasionally gust over 40 miles an hour. Tonight's winds down to only about 20 miles an hour, cloudy. Tomorrow, some intervals of clouds and sunshine, high of 24. And we're keeping an eye on an ice storm that might be in the region on Thursday.
This week on the Retro Cocktail Hour, there's Mambo at the Mocambo. Les Baxter goes Latin, and we'll hear Tiki Lounge TV themes. Carl Brogdon here. Join me where the music is shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.